Okay, good evening everyone, and welcome back to another series, a new term. So the title for this Kabbalah series, this term is the Kabbalah of our roots, understanding on a deeper level the depth behind, the Kabbalistic depth behind our fathers and mothers, our patriarchs and our matriarchs, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. It's a very timely topic because in the parsha of the week that we're reading these weeks, it's all about the history of the fathers and the mothers, our patriarchs, matriarchs. Last week we had all about Abraham and Sarah, then the birth of Yitzchak. This week, of course, is the Shiloh, the marriage between Yitzchak and Rivka, and so on. So, obviously, it's a very, very important part of our history. The genesis of the Jewish nation begin with Abraham, and on a very simple level, the historic context, of course, is Adam and Eve were created in the Garden of Eden, 20 generations later. We have a nation, a civilization which is completely steeped in pagan worship. Belief in God or godly consciousness or awareness is almost completely gone. Comes Abraham, the first Jew at a very young age. The Midrashim and the Rambam discuss the various opinions about what age exactly it happened, but at a very young age, he understands there must be a creator of the universe. He discovers God, so to speak, and he begins the movement of monotheism, essentially. Does outreach, reaches out to many, many hundreds and thousands, and revives the whole belief, the concept of belief in God, belief in one God, belief in creation, belief in the creator of the universe. And then he marries Sarah, of course, Yitzchak and is his son, Yaakov, his grandson, and that's the beginning of the Jewish people. But of course, it's not just the historic concept. The avot, the imahot, the patriarchs and matriarchs, of course, are much, much deeper than that. They become the foundation of Judaism. Not just historically our parents, because as the Talmud says, En korin le'avot ela lishlosha, en korin le'imahot ela la'arba'a. There are only three people that we can refer to as fathers. There are only three people that as Jews we can refer to as mothers. Sorry, only four people were referred to as mothers. So the three people are Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and then, of course, the four mothers are Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Now, what that means is that they are considered the fathers and the mothers of the Jewish people. Now, it's interesting that one of the mothers, for example, is Rachel and Leah. Now, not everyone comes from Rachel and Leah. So the concept of fathers and mothers, therefore, teaches us it's not just a ancestry thing, it's a foundational thing. So it could be that a person was from the tribe of Yosef, for example, which means that that person comes from Rachel, and yet Leah is still considered our mother, and vice versa. And also we until in biblical times, in temple times, the Jewish nation were divided into 12 tribes, meaning when I say they were all still are divided into 12 tribes, but we were aware of which tribe we came from. People knew what tribe they belonged to. So, for example, if someone came from the tribe of Reuben or Shimon, it still wouldn't be that person has four fathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Reuben, for example. It would still be that the fathers are only Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. So, what that teaches us is that there's a very deep foundational concept here of the fathers and the mothers, that not only they're ancestral concepts, but they are foundational concepts. So much so that the rabbis teach us that maaseh avot siman lebanim, that whatever happened historically to the three fathers and the four mothers in these parashiyot, in the parashah that we're reading these days, was a prelude, that gave koyach, gave power, laid the foundation stone to what was going to come for the descendants, for the children. So we need to understand what does it mean. Now, tonight, what I'm going to do is just give a deep Kabbalistic idea in general, the role of the fathers and the role of the mothers, the role of the patriarchs, the role of the matriarchs. And then next week, we're going to go more specifically into some of them and like understand Rachel and Leah, understand where Sarah stood, where Rivka stood, and so on and so forth. So I want to begin with a, to understand this, I'm going to begin with a, just take you on a journey a little bit for a few minutes, share with you a Kabbalistic idea. And it goes in a few stages, and it goes like this. We know that God created the world. God has many names. We've talked about this before. The names of God are not his exclusive names, but they are manifestations of God. As we know that when Moses stood at the burning bush and was about to be sent into Egypt, he asked God, I'm going to tell the Jewish nation, I'm going in your, with your mission to the Jewish people. The first thing they're going to ask me is, what is his name? What is this messenger's, what is this, what is the sender's name, so to speak? And God said, I have no specific name, but I'm called according to my activities. So whatever I happen to be doing at the time, that's my name. What this means, of course, on a deeper level is that God is beyond description. A name is a description. A name describes the person that has the name. In fact, the Talmud says that Rabbi Meir, the great Rabbi Meir, was able to tell the characteristics of a person by his or her name. God says, I have no name, because God transcends the concept of definition and description. Nevertheless, if I choose to manifest myself in a particular way, I'm called by a name that describes that manifestation. So, for example, God said, when I do chesed, when I do kindness to the world, I'm called by the name Kael, Aleph Lamed. When I wage war against the wicked, I'm called Tzvaot, which is like a god of an army, a god of legions, and so on. But the two sort of most common names that are used is Elohim, spelled Aleph Lamed Hey Yud Mem, Elohim, and the name of God, which is the holiest name of God, called the name of Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey, which we pronounce Adon, right? Now, what is the fundamental difference between these two names? So we know that the name of Elohim, Kabbalistically, is the name of Tzimtzum, which means it's the name where God conceals his infinity and makes room for a finite existence. So if you have a look at the beginning of Bereshit, if you look at the beginning of Genesis, in the 6 days of creation, you will notice that the only name of God that appears in those paragraphs is the name of Elohim. Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. Right? But Elohim created, the name of Elohim. Why? Because when God created the world, and throughout the whole 6 days, Vayomer Elohim, God said, Yihyor, Elohim said, let there be trees, and so on. Why is that? Because when God created the world, he, by definition, by choice, designed a universe of concealment. The world was created through God hiding his infinite presence, and therefore making room and making way for a finite world. Right, for a world where his presence would not be obvious, where his infinity would not be obvious, a world where it is possible not even to be conscious of who created the world, and that's all to do with the power of God to use the idea of Tzimtzum, as Kabbalah tells us, the idea to conceal himself, limit himself, conceal his infinite presence, and that's why the source of the universe, the source of creation, is from the name Elohim. However, the purpose of creation, our role, particularly as Am Yisrael, as Jews, is to reveal God's infinite presence. And that is the name of Hashem, of Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. Now, just to make things easier, I'm going to share a screen of some of these things on it. Give me 1 second. There we are. Everyone can see that? Okay. So we have the name of Elohim, right? This one over here. And then we have Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey. Now, Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey is four letters. It's the famous four letters of God, the holiest name of God. And if you look carefully at the Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, you'll see that there's three words there. Haya, he was. Hoveh, he is. And Yiyeh, and he will be. Right? That was the omnipresence of God, the omnipotence of God, the infinity of God was is and will be completely transcends the concept of time and space. Our role is to draw down, to reveal in the world through connecting to God, through Torah, through mitzvot, to reveal in the world the infinite presence of God. Incidentally, in the Chumash, you will see that it is only once man and woman, Adam and Chava, are created, and Shabbat descends into the universe, where we suddenly find the name of Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey mentioned. Now, just to digress for a moment, there's a fascinating little hint to this whole concept. When we make Kiddush on Friday night, right? So it was only once the human being was created that the mission of revealing God's infinite presence to the world began. And it started with the power and the holiness of Shabbat. Shabbat, the world is elevated. Shabbat, the world is elevated to a higher level. And what's interesting is that on Friday night, when we recite Kiddush, if you look at number 3 over here on the handout, Kiddush begins with the 4 words, Yom HaShishi VaYechulu HaShamayim. Now, it's always interesting to note that why do we start with the words Yom HaShishi? The two words Yom HaShishi in the Torah itself actually belong to a previous sentence. If you look in the 6 days of creation, at the end of every one of the days of creation, it says it was evening, it was day, and then the first day, the second day, the third day. Like Vayerev Vayiboker Yom Echad, Vayerev Vayiboker Yom Sheni, and so on. At the end of the 6th day, it says Vayerev Vayiboker, there was evening, there was day, Yom HaShishi, it was the 6th day. End of paragraph. Next paragraph begins the paragraph that describes the Shabbat, and it starts with the words, which is the 3rd and 4th word of Kiddush, Vayechulu HaShamayim Va'aretz V'chol Tzva'am, and the world and the heaven and the earth were finished, and God blessed the 7th day, and so on and so forth. So why would we start in the middle of a paragraph from a sentence, last 2 words of a paragraph that came before this paragraph that is not even about Shabbat? And the answer is that I've probably given it away by the way I've highlighted over here. If you look at the first 4 words of Kiddush, Yom HaShishi Vayechulu HaShamayim, you see the 4 names of God, Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey. The first 4 letters, the first letter of each of those 4 words is God's name, Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey. Okay. Now, because on Friday night, Shabbat begins, and we remind ourselves of the creation of man, Adam and Chava, and the mission that we have as human beings, as Jews specifically, to bring down the infinite presence of God into the world, Yom HaShishi, Vayechul HaShamayim, Yud and Hey, and Vav. Okay. Now, it's going to get a bit technical here, but this is the only way to share this idea. This name of God, Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey, Kabbalistically, there are many, many different formations and many different ways of how this name of God levels. Layers of how this name of God manifests itself and how eventually we are able to bring it into this world. And it has a lot to do with how we spell it out. So there are 2 names of God. For the purpose of this discussion, there are many, there are more, but for the purpose of this discussion, there are 2 names known as Shem Ma, the name of Ma, Mem and He, which has the gematria, the numerical value of 45. And Ban, which is 52. What does that mean? It means like this. If you take the name of God, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, and you spell them out. So for example, the letter Yud is Yud Vav Dalet, right? That's how you spell Yud. If you have a look over here, right? I'm gonna highlight this just so you look up and see it, right? The Yud is Yud Vav Dalet. You spell out the whole letter. Now, some of the letters of God's name, there's different ways of spelling it. So if you spell it using alephs, for example, so you say Yud Vav Dalet, right? Then the Hey you spell Hey Aleph, which is one way to spell a Hey. Excuse me, or Vav you spell Vav Aleph Vav, which is one way to spell a Vav. And then Hey again, Hey Aleph. Right, and you add up all those words, and the gematria, the numerical value of all those letters. So Yud is 10, but Yud Vav Dalet is 20. So because right, Yud is 10, Vav is 6, Dalet is 4. The Hey is 6, the Aleph, the Vav is 13. The Hey is Aleph, you get the Hey again is 6. So altogether you get 45. That's known as the name of Ma. Now I'm going to explain the significance in a minute. This all sounds very technical for the time being, but let me just stay with me for a few minutes. The other name is known as the name of Ban. Ban is 52. And that's when you spell the letters of God's name using Hayes rather than an Aleph. Okay. So Yud is again Yud Vav Dalet. Hey is spelt in this case Hey Hey. Vav is just Vav and Vav. Hey is again is Hey and Hey. Altogether, numerical value is 45. So, sorry, number 45, I mean 52. Right, 52. So the name of 45, which is Ma, that's the name of the Alephs, the name of the holy name of God. We use Alephs to spell out the name. Ban, the name of 52, is when you spell out the letters using the letter Hey rather than the letter Aleph. Now, what's that got to do with everything? So let's stop the sharing here and we'll explain this. Okay. So it's hard to tell when I'm doing this on Zoom if everyone's following. I hope you are. I'm trying to make it as clear as possible. What's the difference between an Aleph and an Hey? So an Aleph is the letter of transcendence. You know, the letter Aleph can be, the word Aleph, Aleph Lamed Pei, can also, if you rearrange the letters, can mean Pele, like one something wondrous, something beyond us, something amazing, like something just out of our reach, something pure, something transcendent. That's the name Aleph. What's the name? What's the significance of a Hey? The letter Hey in Kabbalah always represents the concept of speech, communication, dibur, speech. Why is that? Because we know that the letters divide themselves into what we call Hey Metzora Taper, the five types of letters. There's the guttural letters, the lip letters, and so on. There's five forms of letters. Also, Hey comes from the word, Hey is like the easiest word, letter to say. It's Hevel. It's just like the breath comes out of the word Hey. And that's the beginning of every letter, really. So whatever the case is, the letter Hey is the concept of speech. Now, what is speech? We've spoken about this before, but let me just take it slowly so I understand it. Speech is the ability, right? Communication, letters, words, have two opposite concepts to them. On the one hand, a word is nothing on its own. A word is only as good as the content you put into the word. Yet, words have an amazing power. Words have a power to take ideas which are very deep, which are not revealed to the other, to process them and to communicate them, to reveal them, right? To bring them out to someone else. And when we do that, something amazing happens. On the one hand, speech is just a servant to the content. So all speech does, all words does, is it takes ideas which already exist before the words. The words do not create the ideas. Words take the ideas that already exist before the words and just reveal them. Yet we know that words have this amazing power. Words suddenly bring depth, they bring clarity. They bring power, amazing power to ideas and to feelings and to emotions that didn't exist before. So an example would be, sometimes you understand something really well, but then when you find the words to explain it, suddenly the clarity is even deeper. Or suddenly, as you speak, you discover new things you didn't understand before. Well, let's take a more clear example of an emotion. if you're feeling angry and you speak about it, so yes, on the one hand, all the words are doing is communicating your feeling of anger. But we know that when you start doing that, you become more angry. Anyone, if you ever watch someone who's talking in anger, as they speak, they get more and more angry because speech fuels the emotion, right? We've talked about this before. I'm trying to make it clear again. Or when a positive emotion is the same way, when one expresses words of love, the love becomes stronger. So here we have a paradox of speech. On the one hand, all speech does is, it is just taking what already exists and just finding a way to reveal it, to implement it, to make it accessible to something else. And yet the power to do that is so great that in Kabbalah it says that the power of speech, although it seems just to be a servant to the content which you put into the speech, words have a deeper origin in the soul, a much, much deeper origin, a deeper shoresh, as we call it in Kabbalah, than the other parts of the soul, the other parts of the person. Which is why it says in Kabbalah that hanefesh, the essence of the soul, is filled with words. Because although words, again, on the one hand, it is just taking what already exists, so to speak, yet the power to do that, to process it, to reveal it to something else, to create a product, to give birth to something, is far greater and deeper and higher than the content itself. Now, let's go back to those two names of God. Because in Kabbalah, the two names of God that we described before, Ma and Ban, which means the name of God spelt out with Alephs, and then the name of God spelt out with Hays, represent these two ideas. So the Ma represents the holiness, the infinity of God in its purest form, similar to the content which you're going to put into the words. And the name of God, which is Ban, which is the name of God spelled out with Hays, and Hay represents the concept of speech, represents the ability then to take that purity, that transcendent, infinite power of God's presence, and to bring it into the world, to implement it here, to make it interact with finite existence, to bring it, make it accessible to the finite world. Again, I hope this is clear. I hope it's working. Now, the truth is that we have this formula. Right? We have this formula in Judaism that we need both. Now, you know, these two names of God in Kabbalah are known as Mayim Dchurin Mayim Nukvin, masculine waters or feminine waters, and I'm going to explain that in a moment. Or Mayim Elyonim Mayim Tachtonim, the supernal waters and the lower waters. What does that mean? Water is the idea of giving, chesed. Water flows. Water is the concept of giving. But whenever we reveal something to something else, you need two parts of that formula. So I'll give you an example. In Jewish observance, in Jewish ritual, in Jewish life routine, right? In a Jewish day, the Gemara tells us, the Talmud tells us, that the day is divided into two parts, in a way, right? There's the part of the day where we are immersed in holiness, in transcendence, in detachment from the world. For example, when we get up in the morning, we might daven, we might pray. Prayer is a spiritual experience, somewhat detached from the physical surroundings. It's an escape into a much more pure and spiritual process. Torah learning is a similar concept. Torah learning is the idea where we immerse ourselves in a world which is totally, it might discuss the world, but it's much more of a academic, detached, intellectual, holy world that studying God's Torah and so on. So that's one part of our day. And then, as the Talmud says, we leave the world of spirituality and we go in to the physical world. Hanheg bahem derech eretz, says the Talmud. You then go into the world and you make it work. You implement it. Now, why do we need to start with prayer? Why do we need to start this? Although, what's the purpose of creation? The purpose of creation is to reveal God in the world, to reveal God in the physical creation. Yet, now we do that not through prayer, actually. Right? We know that the Judaism ultimately is not a religion of spirituality. It might sound strange to some people, but it's not. It's about bringing heaven into earth. It's about revealing God in the world. And yet, we have parts of our rituals, parts of our experience, which is very much detachment from the world, like prayer. Prayer is very meditative, much more holy, much more spiritual. But we don't pray all day. We leave that world. We bring it into the more mundane world, right? And we know that Judaism, by definition, is a religion which is much more focused on the mundane. So many mitzvot have to do with eating. So many experiences have to do with physical objects. Most mitzvot are about taking something mundane and elevating it. A piece of parchment, you make a mezuzah. A piece of meat is used for Shabbat. A piece of wheat and flour is made for matzah and Pesach, Sukkah, and all these things. Right? It's all about bringing holiness into the mundane. Yet, we do have experiences which are much more spiritual. And the reason for that is because there needs to be the, what Kabbalah refers to as the Yichud Ma and Ban. It needs to be the combination of those two names of God. The one that is much more transcendent, the Alephs, the detached, and the Hey, which is like communication, bringing it in, revealing it into the world. Why do we need a combination? Because one without the other doesn't work. To just explore a spiritual world, a detached world, we should say, means that we remain in the world of spirituality. We never then interact, we never elevate the mundane. But in order to elevate the mundane, we need to first encounter the spirituality in its purest form. So let's go back to the analogy of speech. The purpose of any idea is to be expressed. It needs to be explained to others. But before you can take an idea and put it into words, you need to have some clarity of the idea in its own right, in its purest form before it went into words. The idea doesn't begin with words. The idea begins before words. It deepens. It clarifies through words, the power of words, the power of implementation, the power of revelation. But first, we know that before speech needs to come thought. Thought is much more detached. It's much more spiritual. So if we speak without thinking, then the speech doesn't work. However, if we think and we don't speak, then the content lacks clarity. The content lacks depth. We don't reach its ultimate depth till it's communicated. But first, you have to have its idea in its own right. Then it can be interacted with the outside world. So go back to a Jewish day. A typical Jewish day first starts with spirituality, spiritual experience. First starts with prayer, moving away from the world, complete spiritual immersion. And then once we have that, then the power that is even a greater power is to take that spirituality and make it work in the world of business, in the world of eating, in the world of sleeping, in the world of the mundane. This is a typical breakup of any day, but the truth is the breakup of the year as well. We know that the very beginning of a Jewish year, which we just had not so long ago, is much more spiritual in its nature. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we detach from the world. We blow shofar, which is a very deep and meditative spiritual experience. We come to Yom Kippur, which is the holiest day of the year. Holiest day of the year is known as Yom Kippur. It's complete detachment. We are elevated to the level of angels, we are taught. We don't eat because we are nourished from a spiritual world the day of Yom Kippur, Kabbalah teaches us. We bury ourselves in the Siddur, in the five prayers of Yom Kippur. Yet when we leave Yom Kippur, the purpose is not Yom Kippur. The purpose is to take the Yom Kippur then into the mundane world, into the physical world, into the rest of the year, which is even greater then. So I'll give you an example. This is the wrong time of the year for this example, but we have the day of Purim, right? And the Zohar tells us that the day of Purim, the happiest day of the year, the day of Purim is very much connected with the day of Yom Kippur. In fact, Yom Kippur, its full name is Yom Kippurim, Day of Atonement, which has in it the word Purim. You get that? Yom Kippurim. But, so, and they're two opposites. Because Yom Kippur is a day of complete spirituality, it's at its highest form, prayer at its greatest climax. And Purim is a day of complete, Purim is not a yontif, meaning you can do work, you can do things when one doesn't do on Shabbat and the Chag. It's not about fasting, it's a mitzvah to eat. We're very merry, we're very celebratory, we even take a bit of a l'chaim. Total opposite days. Yet the Zohar says, which one is higher? Purim is higher than Yom Kippur. And the way the Zohar tells it to us is because Yom Kippur, its full name, as I said before, is Yom Kippurim, which can be also understood is, it can be understood as Yom Kippurim. It's a day like Purim, not quite Purim. Meaning it's like Purim, it doesn't quite make it to Purim. Right? So Yom Kippur, therefore, is the holiest, beautiful day. It's a connection to God like no other day. But nevertheless, it doesn't quite make it to Purim. The ultimate connection to God is Purim itself, where we serve God within food. We serve God with food, with celebration, with the world, with the mundaneness of the world. But here's the trick. Purim is greater than Yom Kippur, but you cannot have Purim without Yom Kippur. You need to first experience, that's why the calendar works. You need to first experience Yom Kippur, like you need to experience prayer in the beginning of the day. And then you can experience Purim. So what does this all have to do with the patriarchs and the matriarchs as the foundations of the Jewish experience? And also, what does it have to do with the fact that there are three fathers and four mothers? I'm just going to share the screen once again. Okay. So Kabbalah teaches us that these two names of God, Ma and Ban, the Aleph, the more transcendent, the detached name of God, and Ban, the more interactive, communicative name of God, which is the Hayz, where it's implemented and revealed and communicated. These are the patriarchs and the matriarchs. So the marriage between the Avot and the Imahot, in fact, this is discussed particularly with regard to the marriage talked about in this week's parasha, which is the marriage between Yitzchak and Rivka, is the coming together, it's the combination, it's the marriage between Ma and Ban, between the name of God, which is with Alephs and Ban. In other words, the Avot, the patriarch represents the name of God, bringing in, introducing, remember the whole mission of the patriarchs and matriarchs was the mission of the Jew, which is to take a world which was created by Elohim, and to reveal godliness in that world. But how does that work? So first you need Ma, like you first need a Yom Kippur. You need the revelation of the infinite presence of God. So we know what we're talking about. We identify what it is that we're going to implement. We're going to reveal in the world. And then we have Ban, which is then taking that pure, infinite presence of God and implementing it into the world, making sure that it actually works in the mundane world. It interacts and is able to work with the physical world. Now, this has to do with the fact also, as Kabbalah explains, the masculine power and the feminine power. So the masculine energy and the feminine energy, we know, is this idea, it's this exact idea. So in Kabbalah, we always talk about this concept that Zahar, the masculine energy, is Mashpia, the giver. The feminine energy is the receiver. So what does that mean? And that's why, by the way, Dibur, communication, is so connected with the feminine energy, which explains why often communication is much stronger in the feminine side of creation. Good communication, effective communication, right? I mean, not to generalize or stereotype, but the fact is, very often men find it much more difficult to communicate than women do, because that's because dibur, speech, is a very feminine concept. It's got to do with the idea of malchut, which is feminine, as I think we've explained other times, right? So what does it mean? Just to give an example. So what's masculine energy? Masculine energy is the creation of newness. So the conception of an idea in its purest form. The feminine energy is taking that idea, processing that idea, and actually giving birth to it. As it works in the reproductive system between male and female, same idea. The male contribution is thousands of potential life, the sperm, the seed, which is just newness. Everyone is a new thing, the potentially to become a baby. And yet without the feminine processing, it will very quickly dissipate. It'll very quickly disappear. Whereas the feminine power is to take that newness in its original form, put it through gestation, process it, and only through that ability to actually give birth to something, to make it work. So the same thing, the role of the avot, the role of the patriarchs, starting with Abraham, is to reveal newness into the world, is to reveal that newness, belief in God, the transcendence of God, the creative power of God, the infinity of God. The role of the matriarch is to make that work, interacting with the world. So I'll give you one or two examples of how this played out in the Avot and the Imahot. This last week's parasha, Abraham has Yishmael, right? Yishmael and Yitzchak. Yishmael is a negative influence. Yishmael is negative. He's threatening Yitzchak and so on and so forth. Sarah understands that the future of the Jewish people will be through Yitzchak, not through Yishmael, and asks Abraham to send Yishmael and his mother away. Abraham doesn't want to do that. Now, in a very simple story, it was his son, a different wife, and he didn't want to. But on a deeper level, he didn't want to because of a different reason. He saw Ishmael in a different light. He didn't see Ishmael for his true colors. What does God say to Abraham? God says to Abraham, "Kol aser tomar lecha Sarah shma b'kola." Whatever Sarah tells you to do, you should listen to him. As Rashi says and the Talmud tells us, because Sarah's power of prophecy was deeper than that of Abraham. What is going on here? So the Kabbalah tells us like this. Abraham belonged to the world of transcendence. When he saw Yishmael, he didn't see Yishmael in this world. He didn't see Yishmael, how Yishmael is operating in this world, in this reality. He saw Yishmael on a higher level. In the higher level, Yishmael worked. But Yishmael doesn't work in this world in terms of the overall mission. That only Sarah can see. So God says to Abraham, ultimately it's got to work in this world. So therefore, in this world, you've got to defer to Sarah. Another example. The famous story coming up, not this Shabbat, but next Shabbat. The relationship between Yitzchak, Rivka, and Yaakov and Esau. So Yitzchak and Rivka marry, and they have two sons, Yaakov and Esau. Yaakov is the tzaddik, he's the pure one, he's the good one. Esau is the wicked son, right? Says the Talmud, says the Pasuk, that Yitzchak loved Esav so much so that he was going to give him the ultimate blessing, which would determine the destiny of the world. He's going to give it away to Esav, and Rivka intervenes and says, no, it's got to work through Yaakov. It's got to go through Yaakov. What's going on here? I'm sharing this briefly, same concept. Yitzchak, transcendence. He sees Esau, but he sees the origin of Esau. He sees the spiritual source of Esau, because Yitzchak's idea is to reveal things as they begin to introduce to the world concepts the way they are in the infinite source. So the Yit, the Esav that he knows is a different Esav. The relationship between him and Esav and Yaakov is a different type of relationship. It's the way it works in the spiritual worlds. It's in the world of man, not in the world of ban. Whereas Rivka sees how these things have to be implemented in this world, sees that the blessings need to be given to Yaakov, and maybe Yaakov ultimately will be able to elevate Esav. Another discussion in its own right. That's the role. But she sees how it works in this world, in the practical way. She's able to bring that monotheism, that kedusha, that holiness, that infinity, which the avot, which the patriarchs introduce into the world and make it work in the world, implement it, make it communicated as the haze are, the dibur, the idea of speech. Now, in the most extreme way, this is described in Kabbalah much in great detail when it talks about the wedding between Yitzchak and Rivka, described in this week's parasha. Because Yitzchak and Rivka represent these two opposites, the combination of both. Yitzchak represents extreme transcendence. You know, Yitzchak, out of the three patriarchs, never left the land of Israel. Yitzchak was elevated through the Akedah, through the binding of Isaac, to the most incredible, lofty level. He was just holiness. He wasn't allowed to leave Israel because he was compared to a sacrifice, a korban that he's just pure, purity, holy. Yitzchak belonged to this detached world, to this transcendent world, which needed to come in and be revealed in the world. Rivka, on the other hand, grew up and was born in an evil society, in the society of Lavan and Betuel, where she was known as Shoshana ben Achochim. She was known as the rose among thorns. She was able to take purity, to take godliness and reveal it in the environment of Haran and Naram Naraim. But there's still a place for Yitzchak, there's still a place for purity, because you cannot have a Purim without a Yom Kippur. You cannot have a day of mundane interaction in business world without the prayer and the detachment and the transcendence which begins at the beginning of the day. They have to work together. It's the combination, as the Kabbalah teaches us, of the Ma and the Ban. This also explains, by the way, why there's three fathers and four mothers. And every Jew, his mother is Rachel and Leah. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel and Leah. Because they're not just physical mothers, biological mothers, they're spiritual mothers. We get our whole basis, our whole mission, our whole role come from the patriarchs and the matriarchs and the combination of the two. So why is it three? Because the Talmud tells us that three is the number of introducing something new. Four is the number of receiving and making it work, processing it. In fact, the Talmud tells us in Masechet Shabbat that Gimel and Dalet, the third and fourth letter of the alphabet, right? Gimel and Dalet stands for Gomel Dalim, to give to the poor. What does that mean? It's a little bit like the relationship between the content of the words and the words themselves. So the words themselves on the one hand are just recipients of the content, but they produce something new out of the content that couldn't be done before. So the gimel is the giving, the dalet, the four, is the receiving. That's why masculine is always, the masculine energy is associated with the letter gimel, the three, whereas the feminine is the letter four. Combination between giving and then receiving and processing. Gomel Dalim. That's why there's three fathers and four mothers. The three fathers is the masculine energy of giving, of introducing something new, something detached, something different, something transcendent. Ma, the name of Ma, and Dalim is then receiving it. The Dalit, the four, which is Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And that's the concept of Avot and Imahot. So our whole life, our whole mission, right, surrounds and incorporates this formula. As a Jew, every one of us has to have both things. Every one of us has this mission to combine the Gimel and the Dalet, to take the loftiest ideas, the most detached ideas, that's the Gimel, that's the Avot, and then bring them down and make them work and introduce them and connect them and show how they can operate and be revealed within the finite world, in the mundane, elevating the mundane. And we all have to have that. So we all have within ourselves the avot and the imahot. We all have the fathers and the mothers. Now we know that as Jews, we don't only come from Abraham, the three fathers and the four mothers, as I said before. We each have an ancestor in the form of a tribe. Those tribes like Reuven, Shimon, Levi, they're all different, spiritually different. They all represent different missions, different roles. For example, we have also the idea that in the Chumash we learn about Aaron HaKohen used to kindle the candelabra each day in the temple. The candelabra had seven branches. And in Kabbalah it teaches us that when the Kohen would kindle the menorah, he would be elevating the seven types of souls. Because just like there's seven midot, there's the seven types of personalities, chesed, gvura, tiferet, and so on. We each serve our God in our unique way, so we're each different. That's always different tribes. This one is more chesed, this one is more gvura, and so on and so forth. So those are specific. So we have different missions. We have different roles. Different tribes have different roles. Different ways to express the same Torah, the same mitzvot. We have, for example, the famous idea of Yisachar and Zvulun. Two tribes, Yisachar was much more focused on learning Torah, Zvulun was much more focused on commerce, right? So yes, there are 12 tribes, there are seven branches of the menorah, there are different sects, different groups, because and they all believe in the same values, but we implement them in different ways. That's true. However, we all have the same three fathers and same four mothers. Why? Because at the very essence, whatever we do, whatever our pathway is, whatever our role is, our mission is, we all have to have this formula of the Gimel and the Dalet, which plays out very much in the way we serve God. In other words, like this. The way we all serve God is we have these two experiences. We have spirituality, where we should engage in the Yom Kippur, we should engage in complete spiritual experiences like davening, like learning, like fasting sometimes, right? Like meditating. But they are all a means to an end. They're all things we need to do with which out we cannot operate. In other words, because we don't know then what to implement. So we need that introduction of newness, the masculine introduction, the three fathers, the Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, who introduce what they see in the supernal world, they introduce it to us. And we all have to have that. We all have to have moments of our life where we're completely immersed in transcendence, in things which are completely different and detached. But we also have to have the Dalit. We also have to have the four Imahot. We have to then take that spirituality, take that intensity, and reveal it in the world. Make it be felt in what we do in a physical way. That our eating becomes different. Our business becomes different. Our routine becomes different. Our mundaneness becomes different. And we have this concept where we reveal this connection to God in everything that we do. In a way, this is also the difference between Torah and mitzvot. I mean, there's different ways to sort of explain this, but this is another way of doing it. The concept difference between Torah and mitzvot, right? So in Judaism, one of the two fundamental things we do is we learn Torah and we perform mitzvot. In a way, it's the same idea. Torah is detached from the world, it's holiness. When we learn Torah, we often learn Torah that's not even relevant. We don't always learn things that are relevant. We learn things of just the wisdom of God, the pure wisdom of God, the transcendence, just the godly word. And then we perform mitzvot. Mitzvot is how we implement that knowledge. We make it work. We take something physical. In Torah, we don't take anything physical. We might talk about physical things, but we don't take anything. We don't. If a person learns Torah, it's a detached experience. You know, when a person learns in yeshiva, for example, it's complete escape. But then there's mitzvot. Mitzvot means you actually have to make it work. The person, as the prekei avot, the ethics of the fathers tells us that if someone says that he only learns Torah, doesn't have anything else, then he's missed the whole point. Point is to make it work within society. On the other hand, we cannot have mitzvot without Torah. Besides the practical level that we don't know what to do. But the mitzvot are listed because mitzvot, we interact with the physical, therefore we become physical. We need that introduction. We need that holiness first. Similar to the idea of Torah mitzvot, the avot and the imahot, the patriarchs, the matriarchs, same sort of formula. And that is our whole formula. That's why These are the three fathers and the four mothers of the entire Jewish nation. So this is an important perspective, which actually makes Judaism very different of how we begin each day. Because I'll just finish with this idea. Because the marriage between the two means that when we're involved in the one, we need to know about the other. So I'll give you just an example. In the Talmud, when it describes prayer, right? Describes prayer. It says when we say the Amidah, which is a very, very pure and holy experience, we're supposed to be Einav Lemata, Libo Lemala ve'Einav Lemata. So simply put, our heart should be connected upwards, our eyes should be looking downwards. What does that mean? That means that when we pray, for example, which is a very spiritual experience, our heart is upwards, our heart is connected to something much higher than us. However, our eyes must be looking beyond. In other words, when we're involved with the spirituality, the purpose has to be, what am I going to do with this? And this has a lot to do with Jewish approach to meditation, for example, and meditative experiences, right? Which makes it unique and different to other forms of meditation and other forms of spirituality. In other disciplines of meditation and spirituality, very often the meditative experience is an end in itself. Detachment is a goal in itself. Abstinence, detachment, being far away. Now, that's an end in itself. Not so in Judaism. In Judaism, when we engage in meditative experiences, and it has a very strong place, prayer, for example, if done properly, is a very meditative experience, or just general meditation, as we've talked about many times, the idea of, you know, just stopping, entering into a state of being rather than a state of doing, being very involved in just being aware of our soul, of our neshama, as we often talk about. That's a very, very important part, but it's not an end in itself. And therefore, because it's not an end in itself, it makes a difference to the meditation experience itself. But when we do that, we always have to have our eye on what's the goal. The goal is to take that connection and reveal it in the non-meditative experience, reveal it in the mundane experience. And it's the same idea, it's the Kabbalistic idea of the marriage between the patriarchs and the matriarchs, the avot and the imahot. That's just a very general introduction to the concept of our ancestry and the foundation of Jewish experience. What I'm doing next week is I'm going to take some specific stories of the avot and the imahot and give them a Kabbalistic explanation to get further depth and to understand who they were and how they operated and what role they each play. So we'll leave it there for tonight and join us again next week. And have a good night, everyone.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're very welcome. All of this.
Thank you, Rabbi. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Very welcome.